This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As you no doubt know, the presidential campaigns have been talking about immigration in the country, everything from reform that would be a roadmap to citizenship to building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. We've had immigration arguments for a long time, about as long as the U.S. has been a country, and these debates always escalate when the U.S. economy takes a downturn. In fact, when there are labor shortages, we turn to Mexico. We encourage immigration. The moment the economy tanks, we want to send those workers packing back to Mexico, and this country has actually pushed Mexican immigrants out of the country, even when some were actually U.S. citizens. Here to discuss some of this history are Maria Cotera, an associate professor at the University of Michigan, and Elena Harada, a community activist and whose family was sent from Detroit to Mexico and has documented that almost forgotten part of history. So, Elena, let's start with your family's history briefly. When did they come to Detroit, and how and why were they pushed out?
Well, my family came to Detroit in 1920, recruited by Ford, like many others. My grandfather actually served in the war. And he was he worked on the railroad, and he was in New York.
So he's in World War One.
He was in World War One,
and there was a labor shortage because all the doughboys were overseas.
Yes, he actually had served in the war, which became an important point later. So my family was repatriated during the Depression, along with about maybe 15,000 other Mexicans from Detroit, about a million across the country. And there's a lot of debate about those numbers, and no one can say for sure what those numbers were, because most people did not sign in when they came back, and there were many people who were just put on trains and in caravans and sent away.
When you say were sent back, was this the government forcing them onto trains? Was this business interests saying, you've got to go, we don't have enough jobs for anybody else? How did that and who did that?
Well, it was actually the Department of Labor that carried out the beginning of it. There wasn't really it wasn't immigration. It wasn't an act of Congress. There were hearings in Congress, but there was never an actual official act. And it was actually done by political pressure and policy. And it was done very lawlessly.
And some of these people of Mexican heritage were actually U.S. citizens.
60% of them were U.S. born. My father and all of his siblings were born in the U.S. In fact, my grandparents took their children. My grandparents were Mexican nationals. They took their children to Mexico to stay with the grandmother. Their children were born in Detroit. They were U.S. citizens. My grandparents, who were Mexican nationals, returned and worked. So they were sending money home to their U.S.-born children. And my grandfather could work on the WPA because he had served in the war.
But later, when those children wanted to come to the U.S., what happened?
Well, they came back in 2 years. And it's been very, very hard to get people to talk about this in our history. It's very hard for people to talk about the Mexican repatriation in the Mexican communities across the country. This was very true for Detroit, but it also turned out to be true everywhere else. And Detroit sort of broke the story on it. Detroit was one of the heavily impacted cities because every place where there was heavy recruitment for industry, there was a lot of Mexicans that came to those places and worked and then were turned back when the economy was taking a dive. So places like Detroit, Chicago, Lafayette, Indiana, all over the Midwest where there was heavy industry, there was Mexican communities. They were recruited to come. They were invited to work. Sound familiar? So they were recruited to come, and then when there was this very nativist sort of culture took hold, very much like what Trump is doing now, by turning people against anyone who may have come for an opportunity. So they were sent back, but some places reported that they were held at gunpoint and forced into paddy wagons and trucks. Others simply got a knock on the door from the welfare department and were told that they had to leave. There was a variety of ways.
Maria, it seems this repatriation has become a cyclical thing. What does the research show? Because this happened in the late 19th century. It happened post-World War I and while the Depression was on, and it happened again in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what is at stake with the sort of recruitment, the cyclical recruitment and repatriation of labor is controlling and creating flexible labor pools that are essentially at your beck and call, right, or at the state's beck and call, who's working in the interest of industry. And we see different kinds of sort of labor that are repatriated or deported. In the 50s with Operation Wetback, you really saw a focus on agricultural labor, right? Because the Bracero program, which was a binational agreement between the U.S. and Mexico to bring in agricultural labor during the Second World War, when those laborers were perceived as no longer needed, you had the enactment of Operation Wetback, which was a policy to deport many of the people who had left the Bracero program and settled out in agricultural communities.
Now, we just heard a reference to Donald Trump. Are we seeing this same kind of thing? I mean, this is a nation of immigrants. The anti-immigration movement today seems to be focused on Hispanic, Latino immigrants mm-hmm. and refugees from the Middle East. Is this more about race than about immigration?
Well, I mean, I just want to point one thing out is that even before Trump, over the last decade, we've seen a focus on primarily Mexican and Latino labor and calls to repatriate or deport laborers here in the United States from Latin America and Mexico. And you saw this actually in the last election cycle mm-hmm. when Mitt Romney and others were advocating for what was called at that time self-deportation. This is, in fact, the context in which Elena and I partnered up and decided to work on acquainting a broader community with this history, because we saw a lot of resonances in what ICE was doing on the streets of Detroit and all through southeastern Michigan and what the calls for self-deportation were sounding like. So I do think that it's important to remember that even though Latinos are considered by the census, right, as an ethnicity and not a race, they are racialized subjects in our country. And so they become really easily targeted communities when pressures around economic depression start to hit.
Now, Elena, you decided that this point in history, or these points in history, needed to be brought to life. You went out on an oral history project to find these stories. Tell me a little bit about that.
This is a lifelong journey. I was fortunate to be a student in Chicano Boricua Studies at Wayne State University in the 70s. And had I not been in a class of people who were in every way my counterparts, we were the Mexicans that didn't speak Spanish. We were the Mexicans that didn't really have very many, but this is overall for the majority of us, didn't really have close ties to Mexico, but were Chicanos, Mexicans from the U.S. And we learned from our professor, and I will call the name of Dennis Valdez, who told us about this repatriation that had happened. And I was reading about it in my books, and I asked my grandfather about it. I would just rush to him to say, look, this is what happened. No, that didn't happen. And I talked to my father about it, and they said that didn't happen. They basically just denied that there was this deportation. And they were—
Even though they were part of it.
They were part of it, yeah. And maybe because they weren't sent with guns. They weren't like held at gunpoint and deported or carried off by immigration officers, but they were forced out because there wasn't any money for them. There was no way for them to feed their families, and people were literally starving. People were literally losing children to very, very basic childhood diseases. And these were stories that people just didn't want to talk about. But I want to say that we've spent, 30 some years chronicling the history of Mexicans. My work has been mostly in Detroit, but it's also across the state. And then we've gathered with wonderful forces across the country, because every Mexican family, of course, like every other family, has their keepers of the history. And they will say, yeah, you know, I wondered why we never saw this person again or that person again, or what happened to this branch of the family, or why they don't talk about this. And we would begin to be able to pull together the story and put our history back together.
The reason they don't want to talk about it, is it a matter of embarrassment that they were shipped out of the U.S.?
I'll quote my dad because he's not here to argue with me. My dad really hated this project. He really hated it. He died in 2010. And he was, I think, 2 years old when they left and about 4 years old when they returned from Mexico. So he was separated from his parents during that time, along with his other siblings. I didn't want for Mexican people in our elders to say, you know, like we wanted any special treatment. I just wanted to say we need to take our place in the history of building Detroit. We need to say we were here. We built the cars. We built the railroads. We did everything else along with everybody else who was here, because we were really absent in the history books of that period of time.
So what are the lessons that we can learn after seeing Mexican immigrants forced out of Detroit before, after helping to establish the success of the city, and today's immigration and possibly leaving the city? Is there any lesson
Well, I mean, I think that understanding the cyclical nature of the whole question of the immigrant threat is really, really essential, first of all, so that we can be clear-headed about what is actually going on, which is that there are interests that need labor, and those interests don't need labor all the time. And so if our government policy is going to be, vis-a-vis immigrants, is going to be sort of controlled by those business interests, then we need a much more clear-headed response by activists, by scholars, by social service agencies to deal with the fact that there are people in this country who we've brought into this country who have laid down stakes in this country that we also owe something to. And they're not disposable people. They can't just be gotten rid of when we no longer, quote unquote, need them. I think there are larger historical lessons we can learn, and I think Elena can speak to those and the importance of recovering this history.
Elena, we'll give you the last word.
I think that it's really important to know that not a border, not a policy, not a politician can stop the human impulse for a family, for a person reaching their dreams, and for creating something better for their children than they had for themselves. All of us are products of that impulse. Nothing is going to stop that. And I have great faith in the possibilities, and it doesn't matter what anybody does about immigration policy, because I think the world over, all immigrants trying to travel to anywhere they're trying to get to survive have got to prevail.
That's Elena Harada. She's a community activist in Detroit. And we also heard from Maria Katera, an associate professor in the Literature, Science, and Arts Department at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.